and tonight I had found my lucky table, for in 20 minutes I was already $150 to the good. I caught the eye of a young European woman across the table. She smiled and began to follow my stakes, saying a word to her companion, a fat man with an enormous cigar, who fed her with tokens and never played himself. But the table which was so lucky for me was unlucky for Marcel. Sometimes we placed our stakes on the same square, and then I lost. I began to wait until he had laid his tokens before I placed my bet, and the girl, who saw what I was at, followed suit. It was as though we were dancing in step, as in a Malayan ronron, without touching. I was content because she was pretty, and because I remembered Monte Carlo. As for the fat man, I could deal with that trouble later. Perhaps he, too, belonged to the Banque de l'Indochine. Marcel was following a mad system. It was as though he were bored with the game, and the quicker he lost, the quicker he could leave the table. Then he saw me, and shoveling together the remainder of his tokens, he laid them all on zero, which had not come up for more than 30 turns. He lost, of course, as one always loses with a desperate throw, and he pushed back his chair. I leant across to him with a $10 token. "Have a bit of my luck," I said. Was I trying to humiliate him, to remind him that he had been my mother's paid lover? I don't remember now, but if that was my motive, I certainly failed. He took the token and replied with great courtesy in his careful French, "Tout ce que j'ai eu de chance dans ma vie m'est venu de votre famille." He bet again on zero, and zero came up. I hadn't followed him. He returned me my token and said, "Excuse me, I must go away now. I have a great need to sleep." I watched him leave the salle. He had over $300 to change now. He was off my conscience. And though he was certainly very black and very big, it was unfair, I thought, to have called him, as my mother had done, a beast. Somehow all the seriousness was drained out of the salle when he left. We were all small-timers now, playing for fun, risking nothing and gaining nothing but the price of a few drinks. I raised my winnings to $350 and dropped them to $200, only for the pleasure of seeing the man with the cigar lose a little too. Then I stopped. Exchanging my tokens, I asked the cashier who the girl was.
"Madame Pineda," he said. "A German lady."
"I don't like Germans," I said with disappointment.
"Nor do I."
"Who is the fat man?"
"Her husband, the ambassador. He named some small South American state, but I forgot it the next moment. I used to be able to distinguish one South American republic from another by the postage stamps, but I had left my collection behind at the College of the Visitation, as a gift to the boy whom I considered my greatest friend. I have long forgotten his name."
"I don't like ambassadors much either," I told the cashier.
"They are a necessary evil," he replied, counting out my dollar notes.
"You believe that evil is necessary? Then you're a Manichaean like myself." Our theological discussion could go no further, for he had not been educated at the College of the Visitation, and in any case the girl's voice interrupted us.
"Husbands, too?"
"What about husbands?"
"A necessary evil," she said, putting down her tokens on the cashier's desk.
We admire the qualities which are beyond our reach, so I admired loyalty, and at that moment I nearly walked away from her forever. I don't know what restrained me. Perhaps I detected in her voice another quality which I find admirable, the quality of desperation. Desperation and truth are closely akin. The desperate confession can usually be trusted, and just as it is not given to everyone to make a deathbed confession, so the capacity for desperation is granted to very few, and I was not one of them. But she had it, and it excused her in my eyes. I would have done better to have followed my first thought and walked away, for I would have walked away from a lot of unhappiness. Instead, I waited for her at the door of the salle while she picked up her winnings. She was the same age as the woman I had known in Monte Carlo, but time had reversed our ages. The first woman had been old enough to be my mother, and now I was old enough to be this stranger's father. She was very dark and small and nervous. I would never have taken her for a German. She came towards me, counting her dollars, to hide her timidity. She had made a desperate cast, and now she didn't know what to do with the bite at the end of her line. I asked, "Where's your husband?" "In the car," she said, and looking out I noticed for the first time the Peugeot car with the CD plates. In the front seat beside the wheel the big man sat smoking his long cigar. His shoulders were wide and flat. You could have hung a poster on them. They looked like a wall closing a cul-de-sac. "When can I see you again?"
"Here, outside, in the car park. I can't come to your hotel."
"You know who I am?"
"I ask questions, too," she said.
"Tomorrow night?"
"At 10. I must be back at 1.
"And now, will he want to know what's kept you?"
"He has infinite patience," she said. "It is a diplomatic quality. He waits to speak till the political situation is ripe."
"Then why must you be back at 1?
"I have a child. He always wakes around 1 and calls for me. It's a habit, a bad habit. He has nightmares about a robber in the house."
"Your only child?"
"Yes."
She touched my arm, and at that moment the ambassador in the car put out his right hand and sounded the horn, twice, but not too impatiently. He didn't even turn his head, or he would have seen us. "You're summoned back," I said, and with my first claim on her, the shadow of other claims fell on me.
"I suppose it's nearly 1, she added quickly. "I knew your mother. I liked her. She was real."
She went out to the car. Her husband opened the door for her without turning, and she got behind the wheel. The end of his cigar glowed beside her cheek like a warning lamp at the edge of a road under repair. I went back to the hotel, and Joseph met me on the steps. He said that Marcel had come back half an hour before and asked for a room for that night.
"Only for tonight?"
"He say he go tomorrow." He had paid in advance, putting down the sum which he knew to be correct. He had ordered 2 bottles of rum to be sent up, and he asked if he might have the room of Madame la Comtesse. He could have had his old room, but then I remembered that the new guest, an American professor, was there. I wasn't unduly troubled. In a way, I was touched. I was glad that my mother had been so liked by her lover and by the woman in the casino, whose first name I had forgotten to ask. I would have liked her myself, perhaps, if she had given me half a chance. Perhaps I had in mind the hope that her likability might have been passed on to me, a great advantage in business, as well as 2/3 of her hotel. 4. I was nearly half an hour late when I found the car with the CD sign outside the casino. There had been a great deal to keep me, and I was not really in the humour to come at all. I couldn't pretend to myself that I was in love with Madame Pineda. A bit of lust and a bit of curiosity was all I thought I felt, and driving into town I remembered everything in the register against her: that she was a German, that she had made the first move, that she was an ambassador's wife. I would certainly hear the chandeliers and the cocktail glasses tinkle in her conversation. She opened the car door for me.
"I nearly gave you up," she said.
"I'm sorry. A lot of things have happened."
"Now you are here, we had better drive away. Our colleagues begin to arrive after 11, when the official dinners are over."
She backed the car out. "Where are we going?" I asked.
"I don't know."
"What made you speak to me last night?"
"I don't know."
"You followed my luck?"
"Yes, I suppose I was curious to see what your mother's son was like. Nothing new ever happens here."
Ahead of us, the port lay in a wash of temporary floodlights. 2 cargo ships were being unloaded. There was a long procession of bowed figures under sacks. She swung the car round in a half circle and brought it into a deep patch of shadow close to the white statue of Columbus. "None of our kind come here at night," she said, "and so no beggars come either."
"What about the police?"
"The CD plate has some value."
I wondered which of us was using the other. I had not made love to a woman for some months, and she had obviously reached the dead end of most marriages. But I was crippled by the events of the day, and I wished I had not come, and I couldn't help remembering she was German, even though she was too young to bear any guilt herself. There was only one reason for us both to be here, and yet we did nothing. We sat and stared at the statue, which stared at America. To escape from the absurdity, I put my hand on her knee. The skin felt cold. She wore no stockings. I said, "What's your name?"
"Martha."
She turned as she answered, and I kissed her clumsily and missed her mouth. She said, "We needn't, you know. We're grown-up people." And suddenly I was back in the Hotel de Paris and powerless, and no bird came to save me on white wings. "I only want to talk," she lied to me gently.
"I would have thought you had plenty to talk about at the embassy."
"Last night, would it have been all right if I could have come to your hotel?"
"Thank God you didn't," I said. "There was trouble enough there."
"What kind of trouble?"
"Don't let's talk about it now." Again, to disguise my lack of feeling, I acted crudely. I pulled her body out from under the wheel and thrust her across my thighs, scraping her leg on the radio set so that she exclaimed with pain.
"I'm sorry."
"It was nothing."
She settled herself more easily. She put her lips against my neck, but I felt nothing. Nothing moved in me, and I wondered how long she would put up with her disappointment, if she were disappointed. Then for a long moment I forgot all about her. I was back in the midday heat, knocking at the door of what had been my mother's room, and getting no response. I knocked and knocked, thinking that Marcel was in a drunken sleep.
"Tell me about the trouble," she said. Suddenly I began to talk. I told her how the room boy became anxious, and then Joseph, and how, finally, when there was no reply to my knocking, I used the pass key and found that the door was bolted. I had to tear down the partition between two balconies and scramble from one to the other. Luckily, the guests were away swimming on the reef. I found Marcel hanging from his own belt from the center light. He must have had great resolution, for he had only to swing a few inches to land his toes on the curlicued ends of my mother's great bed. The rum had all been drunk, except for a little in the second bottle, and in an envelope addressed to me he had put what was left of the $300. "You can imagine," I said, "how I've been occupied since. What with the police, and the guests, too. The American professor was reasonable, but there was an English couple who said they were going to report it to their travel agent. Apparently a suicide places a hotel in a lower price bracket. It's not an auspicious beginning."
"It was a horrible shock," she said.
"I didn't know him or care about him, but it was a shock. Yes, it really was a shock. Apparently I shall have to have the room purified by a priest or an ungan, I'm not sure which, and the lamp has to be destroyed. The servants insist on that." It proved a relief to talk, and with words desire came. The back of her neck was against my mouth, and one leg spread-eagled across the radio. She shivered, and her hand shot out, and by bad chance fell on the rim of the wheel and set the klaxon crying. It went on wailing like a wounded animal or a ship lost in fog until the shiver stopped. We sat in silence in the same cramped position, like two pieces of machinery which an engineer has just failed to fit. It was the moment to say goodbye and go. The longer we stayed, the greater demands the future would hold for us. In silence, trust begins, contentment grows. I realized I had slept a moment, woken, and found her sleeping. Sleep shared was a bond too many. I looked at my watch. It was long before midnight. The cranes ground over the cargo ships, and the long procession of workers passed from boat to warehouse bent under their cowls of sacks like Capuchin monks. One leg hurt me. I shifted it and woke her. She struggled away and said sharply, "What's the time?"
11:40.
"I dreamt the car had broken down, and it was 1 in the morning," she said. I felt put in the place where I belonged, between the hours of 10 and 1. It was a daunting thought how quickly jealousy grows. I had barely known her for 24 hours, and already I resented the demands of others.
"What's the matter?" she asked.
"I was wondering when we shall see each other again."
"At the same time tomorrow. Here, this is as good as any other place, isn't it? Take a different taxi driver, that's all."
It wasn't exactly an ideal bed.
"We'll get in the back of the car. It will be all right there," she said, with a precision that depressed me.
So it was our affair began, and so it continued with minor differences. For example, a year later she changed her Peugeot for a newer model. There were occasions, once her husband was recalled for consultation, when we escaped the car. Once, with the help of a woman friend, we passed 2 days together at Cap Haïtien. But then the friend went home. It sometimes seemed to me that we were less lovers than fellow conspirators, tied together in the commission of a crime. And like conspirators, we were well aware of the detectives on our track. One of them was the child. I went over to a cocktail party at the embassy. There was no reason why I should not have been invited, for within 6 months of our meeting, I had become an accepted member of the foreign community. My hotel was a modest success, though I was not content with modesty, and I still dreamt of that first-class cook. I had met the ambassador first when he drove one of my guests, a fellow countryman, back to the hotel after a dinner at the embassy. He accepted and praised one of Joseph's drinks, and the shadow of his long cigar lay for a while across my veranda. I have never heard a man use the word "my" more frequently.
"Have one of my cigars. Please let my chauffeur have a drink."
We spoke of the coming elections.
"My opinion is the doctor will succeed. He has American support. That is my information."
He invited me to my next cocktail party.
Why did I resent him? I was not in love with his wife. I had made her, that was all. Or so I believed at the time.
Was it that in the course of our conversation he had discovered I had been educated by the fathers of the Visitation and claimed a kind of kinship? I was at the College of St. Ignatius in Paraguay, Uruguay, who cares? I learned later that the cocktail party to which in due course I was invited belonged to the second-class order, the first class, where caviar was served, being purely diplomatic, ambassadors, ministers, first secretaries, while the third class was purely duty. It was a compliment to be included in the second, which was supposed to contain elements of fun. There were a number of rich Haitians there with wives of a rare beauty. The time had not yet come for them to flee the country or to remain shut in their houses at night for fear of what might happen to them in the dark, curfewed streets. The ambassador introduced me to my wife, my again, and she led me to the bar to find me a drink. "Tomorrow night?" I asked, and she frowned at me and pursed her lips to indicate I was not to speak, that we were under observation. But it was not her husband whom she feared. He was busy showing off my collection of Hippolyte's paintings to one of his guests, moving from picture to picture, explaining each one, as though the subjects too belonged to him.
"Your husband can't hear in all this din."
"Can't you see," she said, "that he is listening to every word?"
But the "he" was not her husband. A small creature, not much more than 3 feet high, with dark concentrated eyes, was forcing his way towards us with the arrogance of a midget, thrusting aside the knees of guests as though they were the undergrowth of a wood which belonged to him. I saw he had his eyes on her mouth, as though he were lip-reading.
"My son, Angel," she introduced him, and always I thought of him after that in the English pronunciation of the name, like a kind of blasphemy. Once he had regained her side, he hardly left it, though he never spoke at all. He was too busy listening, while his small steely hand grasped hers like one half of a handcuff. I had met my real rival. She told me, when we next met, that he had asked a great many questions about me. "He smells something wrong?" "How could he at his age? He's barely 5. A year passed, and we found ways of outwitting him, but his claims on her remained. I discovered she was indispensable to me, but when I pressed her to leave her husband, the child blocked her escape. She could do nothing to endanger his happiness. She would leave her husband tomorrow, but how could she survive if he took Angel from her? And it seemed to me that month by month the son grew more to resemble the father. He had a way now of saying, "my mother," and once I saw him with a long chocolate cigar in his mouth. He was putting on weight rapidly. It was as though the father had incarnated his own demon to ensure that our affair did not go too far beyond the bounds of prudence. There was a time when we took a room for meeting above a Syrian store. The storekeeper, whose name was Hamid, was completely reliable. It was just after the doctor came to power, and the shadow of the future was there for anyone to see, black as the cloud on Kenskov. Any kind of connection with a foreign embassy had value for a stateless man, for who could tell at what hour he might not have to take political asylum? Unfortunately, though we had both closely examined the store, we did not realize that, in a corner behind the pharmaceutical products, there were a few shelves given up to toys of better quality than could be found elsewhere, and among the groceries, for the luxury trade had not yet entirely ceased, a tin of Bourbon biscuits could occasionally be found, a favorite provender of Angel between meals. This led to our first big quarrel. We had already met 3 times in the Syrian room, which contained a brass bed under a mauve silk counterpane, and 4 hard upright chairs lined along the wall, and a number of hand-tinted photographs of family groups. I think it was the guest room, kept immaculate for some important visitor from Lebanon who never came and never would come. The 4th time I waited for 2 hours, and Martha did not appear at all. I went out through the store, and the Syrian spoke to me discreetly. "You have missed Madame Pineda," he said. "She was here with her little boy."
"Her little boy?"
"They bought a miniature car and a box of Bourbon biscuits." Later that evening she rang me up. She sounded breathless and afraid, and she spoke very rapidly. "I am at the post office," she said. "I've left Angel in the car."
"Eating Bourbon biscuits?"
"Bourbon biscuits? How did you know?" "Darling, I couldn't come to you. When I got to the shop, I found Angel there with his nurse. I had to pretend I'd come to buy him something as a reward for being good."
"Has he been good?"
"Not particularly. His nurse said they saw me come out last week. It was a good thing we never leave together. And he wanted to see where I'd been, and that's how he discovered the biscuits he liked."
"The Bourbon biscuits?"
"Yes. Oh, he's coming into the post office now to find me. Tonight, same place."
The telephone went dead.
So we met again by the Columbus statue in the Peugeot car. That time we didn't make love. We quarreled. I told her Angel was a spoiled child, and she admitted it, but when I said that he spied on her, she was angry, and when I said he was getting as fat as his father, she tried to slap my face. I caught her wrist, and she accused me of striking her. Then we laughed nervously, but the quarrel simmered on, like stock for tomorrow's soup. I said, very reasonably, "You would do better to make a break, one way or the other. This kind of life can't go on indefinitely."
"Do you want me to leave you, then?"
"Of course not."
"But I can't live without Angel. It's not his fault if I've spoiled him. He needs me. I can't ruin his happiness."
"In 10 years he won't need you at all. He'll be slinking off to Mayor Catherine or sleeping with one of your maids. Except that you won't be here. You'll be in Brussels or Luxembourg, but there are brothels for him there, too.
10 years is a long time.
And you'll be middle-aged, and I'll be old, too old to care. You'll live on with 2 fat men, and a good conscience, of course. You'll have salvaged that.
And you? Don't tell me you won't have been comforted by all sorts of women in all sorts of ways.
Our voices rose higher and higher in the darkness under the statue. Like all such quarrels, it led to nothing except a wound which easily heals. There are places for so many different wounds before we find ourselves breaking an old scab. I got out of her car and walked across to mine. I sat down at the wheel and began to back the car. I told myself it was the end. The game wasn't worth the candle. Let her stay with the beastly child. There were many more attractive women to be found at Mayor Catherine's. She was a German anyway. I called, "Goodbye, Frau Pineda," viciously, out of the window as I came parallel to her car. And then I saw her bent over the wheel crying. I suppose it was necessary to say goodbye to her once before I realized that I could not do without her. When I got back beside her, she was already in control.
"It's no good," she said, "tonight."
"No."
"Shall we see each other tomorrow?"
"Of course."
"Here, as usual?"
"Yes."
She said, "There is something I meant to tell you, a surprise for you, something you badly want."
For a moment I thought she was going to surrender to me and promise to leave her husband and her child. I put my arm round her to support her in the great decision, and she said,
"You need a good cook, don't you?"
"Oh, yes, yes, I suppose I do."
"We've got a wonderful cook, and he's leaving us. I engineered a row on purpose and sacked him. He's yours if you want him."
I think she was hurt again by my silence.
"Now don't you believe I love you? My husband will be furious. He said that André was the only cook in Port-au-Prince who could make a proper soufflé."
I stopped myself just in time from saying, "And Angel, he likes his food too." "You've made my fortune," I said. And what I said was nearly true. The Trianon soufflé au Grand Marnier was famous for a time until the terror started and the American mission left and the British ambassador was expelled and the nuncio never returned from Rome and the curfew put a barrier between us worse than any quarrel, until at last I too flew out on the last Delta plane to New Orleans. Joseph had only just escaped with his life from his interrogation by the Tonton Macoute, and I was scared. They were after me, I felt certain. Perhaps Fat Gracia, the head of the Tonton, wanted my hotel. Even Petit Pierre no longer looked in for a free drink. For weeks I was alone with the injured Joseph, the cook, the maid, and the gardener. The hotel had need of paint and repairs, but what good was there in spending the labor without the hope of guests? Only the John Barrymore suite I kept in good order, like a grave. There was little in our love affair now to balance the fear and the boredom. The telephone had ceased to work. It stood there on my desk like a relic of better times. With the curfew, it was no longer possible for us to meet at night, while in the day there was always Angel. I thought I was escaping from love as well as politics when at last I received my exit visa at the police station after 10 hours' wait, with the heavy smell of urine in the air and policemen returning with a smile of satisfaction from the cells. I remember a priest who sat all day in a white soutane and his stony attitude of long and undisturbed patience as he read his breviary. His name was never called. Pinned behind his head on the liver-coloured wall were snapshots of Barbeau, the dead defector, and his broken companions, who had been machine-gunned in a hut on the edge of the capital a month before. When the police sergeant gave me my visa at last, shoving it across the counter like a crust of bread to a beggar, someone told the priest that the police station was closed for the night. I suppose he came back next day. It was as good a place as any other for him to read his breviary, for none of the transients dared to speak to him now that the archbishop was in exile and the president excommunicated. What a wonderful place the city had been to leave, as I looked down at it through the free and lucid air, the plane pitching in the thunderstorm which loomed as usual over Kenskov. The port seemed tiny compared with the vast wrinkled wasteland behind, the dry, uninhabited mountains, like the broken backbone of an ancient beast excavated from the clay, stretching into the haze towards Cap Haïtien and the Dominican border. I would find some gambler, I told myself, to buy my hotel, and I would then be as unencumbered as on the day I drove up to Pétionville and found my mother stretched in her great brothely bed. I was happy to leave, I whispered it to the black mountain wheeling round below. I showed it in my smile to the trim American stewardess bringing me a highball of bourbon and to the pilot who came to report progress. It was 4 weeks before I woke to misery in my air-conditioned New York room in West 44th Street after dreaming of a tangle of limbs in a Peugeot car and a statue staring at the sea. I knew then that sooner or later I would return, when my obstinacy was exhausted, my business deal written off, and half a loaf eaten in fear would seem so much better than no bread. Chapter 4. 1. Dr. Maggio crouched a long time above the body of the ex-minister. In the shadow cast by my torch, he looked like a sorcerer exorcising death. I hesitated to interrupt his rites, but I was afraid the Smiths might wake in their tower suite, so at last I spoke and broke his thoughts. "They can't make it out to be anything but suicide," I said. "They can make it out to be whatever suits them," he replied. "Do not deceive yourself." He began to empty the contents of the minister's left pocket, which was exposed by the position of the body. He said, "He was one of the better ones," and looked with care at each scrap of paper, like a bank clerk checking notes for forgery, holding them close to his eyes, and his big, globular spectacles, which he wore for reading only. "We took our anatomy course together in Paris, but in those days even Papa Doc was a good enough man. I remember Duvalier and the typhoid outbreak in the 20s.
"What are you looking for?"
"Anything that could identify him with you. In this island the Catholic prayer is very apt. The devil is like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour."
"He hasn't devoured you."
"Give him time."
He put a notebook in his pocket.
"We haven't the leisure to go through all this now."
Then he turned the body over. It was heavy to move, even for Dr. Maggio.
"I'm glad your mother died when she did. She had borne enough. One Hitler is sufficient experience for one lifetime."
We talked in whispers for fear of disturbing the Smiths.
"A rabbit's foot," he said, "for luck."
He put the object back.
"And here is something heavy."
He took out my brass paperweight in the shape of a coffin marked R.I.P.
"I never knew he had a sense of humor."
"That's mine. He must have taken it from my office."
"Put it back in the same place."
"Shall I send Joseph for the police?"
"No, no. We can't leave the body here."
"They can hardly blame me for a suicide."
"They can blame you because he chose this house to hide in."
"Why did he? I never knew him. I met him once at a reception, that's all."
"The embassies are closely guarded. I suppose he believed in your English phrase, an Englishman's home is his castle." "He had so little hope he sought safety in a catchword."
"It's the hell of a thing to find on my first night home."
"Yes, I suppose it is. Chekhov wrote, 'Suicide is an undesirable phenomenon.'"
Dr. Maggio stood up and looked down at the body. A colored man has a great sense of occasion. It isn't ruined by Western education. Education only changes the form of its expression. Dr. Maggio's great-grandfather might have wailed in the slave compound to the unanswering stars. Dr. Maggio pronounced a short, carefully phrased discourse over the dead. However great a man's fear of life, Dr. Maggio said, suicide remains the courageous act, the clear-headed act of a mathematician. The suicide has judged by the laws of chance. So many odds against one that to live will be more miserable than to die. His sense of mathematics is greater than his sense of survival. But think how a sense of survival must clamor to be heard at the last moment, what excuses it must present of a totally unscientific nature. I thought that as a Catholic you would have utterly condemned. I am not a practicing Catholic, and in any case you are thinking of theological despair. In this despair there was nothing theological. Poor fellow, he was breaking a rule. He was eating meat on Friday. In his case, the sense of survival did not put forward a commandment of God as an excuse for inaction. He said, "You must come down and take the legs. We have to remove him from here." The lecture was finished, the funeral oration spoken. It was a comfort to feel myself in the large square hands of Dr. Maggio. I was like a patient who accepts without question the strict regime required for a cure. We lifted the Secretary for Social Welfare out of the bathing pool and carried him towards the drive, where Dr. Maggio's car stood without lights. "When you get back," Dr. Maggio said, "you must turn on the water and wash away the blood." "I'll turn it on all right, but whether the water will come..." We propped him on the back seat. In detective stories, a corpse is always so easily made to look like a drunken man. But this dead thing was unmistakably dead. The blood had ceased to flow. But one glance into the car would note the monstrous wound. Luckily, no one dared move on the roads at night. It was the hour when only zombies worked, or else the Tonton Macoute. As for the Tonton, they were certainly abroad. We heard the approach of their car. No other car would be out so late, before we reached the end of the drive. We switched our headlights off and waited. The car was being driven slowly uphill from the capital. We could hear the voices of the occupants arguing above the grind of the third gear. I had the impression of an old car which would never make the grade up the long slope to Pétionville. What would we do if it gave up the ghost at the entrance of the drive? The men would certainly come to the hotel for help, and some free drinks, whatever the hour. We seemed to wait a long time before the sound of the engine passed the drive and receded. I asked Dr. Maggio, "Where do we take him?" "We can't go far, either up or down," he said, "without reaching a block. This is the road to the north, and the militia daren't sleep for fear of inspection. That's probably what the Tontons are doing now. They'll go as far as the police post at Kenskoff if the car doesn't break down." "You had to pass a roadblock to get here. How did you explain?" "I said there was a woman sick after a childbirth. It's too common a case for the man to report, if I am lucky."
"And if he does report?"
"I shall say I could not find the hut."
We drove out onto the main road. Dr. Maggio put on the headlights again.
"If anyone should be out and see us," he said, "he will take us for the Tontons."
Our choice of terrain was severely limited by the barrier up the road and the barrier down. We drove 200 yards uphill.
"That will show that he passed the Trianon. He was not on the way there,"
and turned into the second lane on the left. It was an area of small houses and abandoned gardens. Here had lived in the old days the vain and the insufficiently successful. They were on the road to Pétionville, but they had not quite arrived there. The advocate who picked up the unconsidered cases, the failed astrologer, and the doctor who preferred his rum to his patients.
Dr. Maggio knew exactly which of them still occupied his house and which had fled to escape the forced levies that the Tonton Macoute collected at night for the construction of the new city, Duvalierville. I had contributed 100 gourds myself. To me, the houses and gardens seemed all equally unlived in and uncared for. "In here," Dr. Maggio directed. He drove the car a few yards off the road. We had to keep the headlights burning, for we had no hand free to hold a torch. They shone on a broken board, which now announced only, "Pont, your future by..." "So he's gone," I said. "He died." "A natural death?" "Violent deaths are natural deaths here. He died of his environment." We got the body of Dr. Filippo out of the car and dragged it behind an overgrown bougainvillea where it could not be seen from the road. Dr. Maggio twisted a handkerchief round his right hand and took from the dead man's pocket a small kitchen knife for cutting steaks. His eye had been sharper than mine at the pool. He laid it a few inches from the minister's left hand. He said, "Dr. Filippo was left-handed." "You seem to know everything." "You forget we took anatomy together. You must remember to buy another steak knife." "Has he a family?" "A wife and a boy of 6. I suppose he thought that suicide was safer for them." We got back into the car and reversed into the road. At the entrance of my drive, I got out. "All depends now on the servants," I said. "They'll be afraid to talk," Dr. Maggio said. "A witness here can suffer just as much as the accused." 2. Mr. and Mrs. Smith came down to breakfast on the veranda. It was almost the first time I had seen him without a rug over his arm. They had slept well, and they ate with appetite the grapefruit, the toast, and the marmalade. I was afraid they might require some strange beverage with a name chosen by a public relations firm, but they accepted coffee and even praised its quality. "I woke up only once," Mr. Smith said, "and I thought that I heard voices. Perhaps Mr. Jones has arrived." "No." "Odd. The last thing he said to me in the customs was, 'We'll meet tonight at Mr. Brown's.'" "He was probably shanghaied to another hotel." "I had hoped to take a dip before breakfast," Mrs. Smith said, "but I found Joseph was cleaning the pool. He seems to be a man of all work." "Yes, he's invaluable. I'm sure the pool will be ready for you before lunch." "And the beggar?" Mr. Smith asked. "Oh, he went away before morning." "Not with an empty stomach, I hope." He gave me a smile, as much as to say, "I'm only joking. I know you are a man of good will." Joseph would certainly have seen to that. Mr. Smith took another piece of toast. He said, "I thought that this morning Mrs. Smith and I would write our names in the embassy book." "It would be wise." "I only thought it would be courteous. Afterwards, perhaps I could present my letter of introduction to the Secretary for Social Welfare." "If I were you, I would ask at the embassy whether there has been any change. That is, if the letter is addressed to someone personally." "A Dr. Filippo, I think." "I would certainly ask then. Changes happen very quickly here." "But his successor, I suppose, would receive me. What I have come here to propose would be of great interest to any minister concerned with health." "I don't think you ever told me what you were planning." "I come here as a representative," Mr. Smith said. "Of the vegetarians of America," Mrs. Smith added, "the true vegetarians." "Are there false vegetarians?" "Of course. There are even some who eat fertilized eggs." "Heretics and schismatics have splintered every great movement," Mr. Smith said sadly, "in human history." "And what do the vegetarians propose to do here?" "Apart from the distribution of free literature, translated, of course, into French, we plan to open a center of vegetarian cooking in the heart of the capital."
The heart of the capital is a shanty town.
In a suitable site, then, we want the president and some of his ministers to attend the Gadder opening and take the first vegetarian meal as an example to the people. But he's afraid to leave the palace.
Mr. Smith laughed politely at what he considered my picturesque exaggeration. Mrs. Smith said,
"You can hardly expect much encouragement from Mr. Brown. He is not one of us."
Now, my dear, Mr. Brown was only having a little joke with us. Perhaps after breakfast I could ring up my embassy.
The telephone doesn't work, but I could send Joseph with a note.
No, in that case we'll take a taxi, if you'll get us a taxi.
I'll send Joseph to find one.
He surely is a man of all work, Mrs. Smith said to me harshly, as though I were a southern plantation owner. I saw Petit Pierre walking up the drive, and I left them.
"Ah, Mr. Brown," Petit Pierre cried, "a very, very good morning."
He waved a copy of the local paper and said,
"You'll see what I have written about you. How are your guests?"
"They have slept well, I hope." He mounted the steps, bowed to the Smiths at their table, and breathed in the sweet, flowery smell of Port-au-Prince, as though he were a stranger to the place.
"What a view," he said. "The trees, the flowers, the bay, the palace."
He giggled.
"Distance lends enchantment to the view. Mr. William Wordsworth."
Petit Pierre had not come for the view, I was certain, and at this hour he would hardly have come for a free glass of rum. Presumably he wanted to receive information, unless perhaps he wished to impart it. His gay manner did not necessarily mean good news, for Petit Pierre was always gay. It was as though he had tossed a coin to decide between the only two possible attitudes in Port-au-Prince, the rational and the irrational, misery or gaiety. Papa Doc's head had fallen earthwards, and he had plumped for the gaiety of despair.
"Let me see what you've written," I said. I opened the paper at his gossip column, which always appeared on page 4, and read how, among the many distinguished visitors who had arrived yesterday in the Medea, was the Honourable Mr. Smith, who had been narrowly defeated in the American presidential elections of 1948 by Mr. Truman. He was accompanied by his elegant and amiable wife, who under happier circumstances would have been America's first lady, an adornment to the White House. Among the many other passengers was the well-loved patron of that intellectual center, the Hotel Trianon, who was returning from a business visit to New York. I looked afterwards at the principal news page. The Secretary for Education was announcing a 6-year plan to eliminate illiteracy in the North. Why the North in particular? No details were given. Perhaps he was depending on a satisfactory hurricane. Hurricane Hazel in 54 had eliminated a great deal of illiteracy in the interior. The extent of the death roll had never been disclosed. There was a small paragraph about a party of rebels who had crossed the Dominican frontier. They had been driven back, and 2 prisoners had been taken carrying American arms. If the president had not quarreled with the American mission, the arms would probably have been described as Czech or Cuban. I said, "There are rumors about a new secretary for social welfare."
"You can never trust rumors," Petit Pierre said.
"Mr. Smith has brought an introduction to Dr. Philippot. I don't want him to make a mistake."
"Perhaps he ought to wait a few days. I hear that Dr. Philippot is in Cap Haïtien, or somewhere in the north."
"Where the fighting is?"
"I do not believe there is really much fighting."
"What kind of a man is Dr. Philippot?" I felt an itch of curiosity to know more of someone who had become a kind of distant relative by dying in my pool.
"A man," Petit Pierre said, "who suffers very much from his nerves."
I closed the paper and handed it back to him. "I see you don't mention the arrival of our friend Jones."
"Ah, yes, Jones. Who exactly is Major Jones?"
I was sure then that he had come with the purpose of receiving rather than giving information.
A fellow passenger, that's all I know.
He claims to be a friend of Mr. Smith's.
In that case, I suppose he must be.
Petitpierre imperceptibly moved me away down the veranda until we turned the corner out of sight of the Smiths. His white cuffs fell a long way out of his sleeves onto his black hands.
"If you would be frank with me," he said, "I might perhaps be of a little help."
"Frank about what?"
"About Major Jones."
"I wish you wouldn't call him Major. Somehow it doesn't suit him."
"You think perhaps he is not—"
"I know nothing about him, nothing at all."
"He was going to stay at your hotel."
"He seems to have found a lodging elsewhere."
"Yes, at the police station."
"Why on earth?"
"I think they found something incriminating in his baggage. I don't know what."
"Does the British Embassy know?"
"No, but I do not think they can help very much. These things have to take their course. They are not ill-treating him as yet."
"What would you advise, Petitpierre?"
"It is probably a misunderstanding, but then there is always the question of amour-propre. The chief of police suffers a great deal from amour-propre. Perhaps if Mr. Smith spoke to Dr. Filippo, Dr. Filippo might speak to the Secretary for the Interior. Major Jones could then be fined for a merely technical offence."
"But what is his offence?"
"That question is in itself a technicality," he said.
"But you have just told me Dr. Filippo is in the north."
"True. Perhaps Mr. Smith ought rather to see the Secretary of State." He waved the papers proudly. "He will know how important Mr. Smith is, for he will undoubtedly have read my article."
"I shall go at once and see our chargé."
"It is the wrong method," Petitpierre said. "It is far easier to satisfy the amour propre of the chief of police than to satisfy national pride. The Haitian government does not accept protests from foreigners."
It was much the same advice as the chargé gave me later that morning. He was a hollow-chested man with sensitive features, which reminded me the first time I met him of Robert Louis Stevenson. He spoke with many hesitations and an amused air of defeat. It was the conditions of life in the capital that had defeated him, not the inroads of tuberculosis. He had the courage and the humour of the defeated. For example, he carried a pair of black glasses in his pocket, which he always put on when he saw a member of the Tonton Macoute, who wore them as a uniform, to terrify. He collected books on Caribbean flora, but he had sent all but the most common of them home, just as he had sent his children, for there was always the risk of sudden fire aided by a tin of gasoline. He listened to me without interruption or impatience while I told him of Jones's predicament and Petitpierre's advice. I felt sure he would have shown no more surprise if I had told him of the Secretary for Social Welfare dead in my bathing pool, and the way in which I had disposed of the body. But I think he would have been secretly grateful to me that I had not called him in. When I finished my story, he said,
I had a cable from London about Jones.
So did the captain of the Medea. His cable came from the owners in Philadelphia. It wasn't very specific.
Mine, you might say, was cautionary. I was not to be unduly helpful. I suspect some consulate somewhere has been taken for a ride.
All the same, a British subject in prison.
Oh, I agree that it is a little too steep. Only we have to remember, don't we, that even these bastards may have acted with good reason. Officially, I shall proceed with caution, as the cable suggests. A formal inquiry, to begin with.
He made a movement with his hand across the desk and laughed.
I shall never lose the habit of picking up a telephone.
He was the perfect spectator, the spectator of whom every actor must sometimes dream, intelligent, watchful, amused, and critical in just the right way, a lesson he had learned from having seen so many performances, good and bad, in indifferent plays. For some reason I thought of my mother's words to me when I saw her for the last time. What part are you playing now? I suppose I was playing a part, the part of an Englishman concerned over the fate of a fellow countryman, of a responsible businessman who saw his duty clearly, and who came to consult the representative of his sovereign. I temporarily forgot the tangle of legs in the Peugeot. I am quite sure that the chargé would have disapproved of my cuckolding a member of the diplomatic corps. The act belonged too closely to the theatre of farce. He said, I doubt if my inquiries will do much good. I should be told by the Secretary for the Interior that the affair is in the hands of the police. He will probably give me a lecture on the separation of the judicial and executive functions. Did I ever tell you about my cook? It happened while you were away. I was giving a dinner for my colleagues, and my cook simply disappeared. No marketing had been done. He had been picked up in the street on the way to market. My wife had to open the tins we keep for an emergency. Your Señor Pineda did not appreciate a soufflé of tinned salmon. Why did he say my Señor Pineda? Later I heard that he was in a police cell. They released him the next day when it was too late. He had been questioned about what guests I entertained. I protested, of course, to the Secretary for the Interior. I said I should have been told, and I would have arranged for him to go to the police station at a convenient hour. The minister simply said that he was a Haitian, and he could do what he liked with a Haitian.
But Jones is English.
I assume so, but I doubt all the same whether our government in these days will send a frigate. Of course, I'm anxious to help to the best of my ability, but I think Petit Pierre's advice is quite sound. Try other means first. If you get nowhere, of course I'll protest. Tomorrow morning. I have a feeling that this is not the first police cell Major Jones has known. We mustn't exaggerate the situation. I felt a little like the player King rebuked by Hamlet for exaggerating his part. When I got back to the hotel, the swimming pool was full. The gardener was pretending to occupy himself by raking a few leaves off the surface of the water. I heard the voice of the cook in the kitchen. Everything was near to normal again. I even had guests, for there in the pool, avoiding the gardener's rake, swam Mr. Smith, wearing a pair of dark grey nylon bathing pants, which billowed out behind him in the water, giving him the huge hindquarters of some prehistoric beast. He swam slowly up and down, using the breaststroke and grunting rhythmically. When he saw me, he stood up in the water like a myth. His breasts were covered with long strands of white hair. I sat down by the pool and called out to Joseph to bring a rum punch and a Coca-Cola. I was uneasy when Mr. Smith trundled to the deep end before he emerged. He was passing so close to the spot where the Secretary for Social Welfare had died. I thought of Holyrood and the indelible mark of Rizzio's blood. Mr. Smith shook himself and sat down beside me. Mrs. Smith appeared on the balcony of the John Barrymore suite and called down to him, "Dry yourself, dear, or you might catch cold."
"The sun will dry me quickly enough, dear," Mr. Smith called back.
"Put the towel round your shoulders, or you'll burn." Mr. Smith obeyed her. I said, "Mr. Jones has been arrested by the police."
"My goodness, you don't say. What has he done?"
"He hasn't necessarily done anything."
"Has he seen a lawyer?"
"That's not possible here. The police wouldn't allow it." Mr. Smith gave me an obstinate look.
"The police are the same everywhere. It happens often enough at home," he said. "In the South, colored men shut up in jail refused a lawyer, but two wrongs don't make a right."
"I've been to the embassy.
They don't think they can do much.
Now, that is scandalous, Mr. Smith said. He was referring to the attitude of the embassy rather than to the conditions of Jones's arrest.
Petitpierre thinks that the best thing at the moment would be for you to intervene, to see the Secretary of State, perhaps.
I'll do anything I can for Mr. Jones. There's obviously been a mistake. But why does he suppose I would have any influence?
You were a presidential candidate, I said, as Joseph brought the glasses.
I'll do anything I can, Mr. Smith repeated, brooding into his Coca-Cola. I very much took to Mr. Jones. I don't know why it is I can't get round to calling him Major. After all, there are some good men in all armies. He seemed to me the best type of Britisher. There must have been a foolish mistake somewhere.